When needed for can making, the aluminum coils are shipped by truck, by sea, and again by truck to the can maker in England, where the coils are unloaded and stored, again for about 2 weeks. When needed, the coils are taken from storage to the can making machinery and run through a blanking machine which punches circular discs out of the aluminum sheet at the rate of 4,000 per minute. The discs are then fed automatically into wall drawing machines, which punch the disc 3 times in succession to create a can without a top at the rate of 300 cans per minute per machine. 13 forming machines are downstream from each blanking machine. From the forming machines, the cans travel by conveyor through a washer, a dryer, and a paint booth applying a base coat and then a top coat consisting of the Cola color scheme plus consumer information in different languages and varying promotional messages. The cans then travel through lacquering, necking, and flanging to prepare the cans to receive their tops after filling, bottom and inside spraying to prevent discoloration and any aluminum taste from getting into the cola, and on to final inspection. The can-making machinery just described, really just one big interconnected machine, is a technical marvel capable of converting a sheet of aluminum into a finished painted can with no human intervention in less than 10 seconds of actual processing time. However, it is also extremely expensive to change over from one type of can to the next and one paint scheme to the next, so management tries to produce large lots of each type. From the can maker's standpoint, this is clearly the most economical approach, and it also meshes with the practice of the smelter, hot roller, and cold roller of processing specific types of aluminum in large batches. After inspection, the cans proceed to an automated palletizing machine, which loads the empty cans on pallets, 8,000 to each pallet, and sends them to a massive warehouse for storage until needed, usually 4 weeks. In the warehouse, they are stored by type of can because the bottling firm eventually filling the cola cans needs a variety of cans with different labels for beverages besides plain cola, for example, diet cola, caffeine-free cola, cherry cola. And even for plain cola, the bottler must support many different packaging configurations and promotional campaigns. Each package and many marketing campaigns require different information to be painted on the cans. From the can maker's warehouse, the cans are trucked to the bottler's warehouse, where they are stored again, although this time only for about 4 days. They are then depalletized and loaded into massive can filling machines, where they are washed and filled. It is at this point that the major tributary streams converge in a massive tank adjacent to the filling machine. In this step, water, caramels, sugar, and essence are carefully mixed, and carbon dioxide, the fizz, is added to create cola. The value streams for these items also require detailed analysis by Tesco, the bottler, and their suppliers, but the method for value stream analysis is best illustrated by sticking to the longest stream. After the cola is poured into the cans at the rate of 1,500 cans per minute, the cans are sealed with an aluminum can end containing the familiar pop top, supplied through a separate but very similar process by the can maker. The cans are then date stamped and packed into cartons of varying numbers of cans, 8 in the present case. Each type of carton has its own paint scheme and promotional information. The mixing and filling process, which brings all of the tributary value streams together, requires only 1 minute to proceed from washing to packing, but it is expensive and time-consuming to change over. In addition, putting cola in a few cans and then a clear soda in the next can requires purging the whole system, so the bottlers found it most economical to run large lots of each type of beverage through its complex equipment. At the end of the filling packing line, the cartons are palletized and stretch-wrapped, then taken to the bottler's central warehouse serving all customers in the United Kingdom. Storage time for the pallets of cola is about 5 weeks. At the warehouse, the pallets are sorted and placed in designated areas by type, a process called stocking. They are then picked, as needed, and loaded onto one of the bottlers' trucks for conveying to one of Tesco's regional distribution warehouses around the United Kingdom. Once at the Tesco warehouse, things move much faster. Incoming pallets are stored for about 3 days before cases are taken from the pallets and placed in roll cages going overnight to each store. Once at the retail store, the roll cages are taken from the receiving dock to a storage area in the rear or directly to the shelves, and the cola is sold in about 2 days. When the cola is taken home, it is typically stored again, at least for a few days, perhaps in the basement if the shopper has bought a number of cartons to take advantage of a special promotional offer. Then it's chilled and, finally, consumed. The last step probably requires about 5 minutes, after nearly a year along the value stream. A final important step is recycling the can to reintroduce it into the production process at the smelting stage. In the mid-1990s, only 16% of aluminum cans in the UK were recycled and shipped back to Norway, but the percentage was rising. If the percentage of cans recycled moved toward 100%, interesting possibilities would emerge for the whole value stream. Many smelters with integrated mini-rolling mills might be located near the can makers in England, eliminating in a flash most of the time, storage, and distances involved today in the steps above. These activities would suddenly convert from type 1 Muda, in our typology, waste but unavoidable, to type 2 Muda, waste that can be completely eliminated right away. The slow acceptance of recycling is surely due in part to the failure to analyze cost in the whole system rather than just for the recycling step in isolation. Look at the physical production of cola, action by action, and the results are highly thought-provoking. First, the amount of time when value is actually being created, 3 hours, is infinitesimal in relation to the total time, 319 days, from bauxite to recycling bin. More than 99% of the time, the value stream is not flowing at all. The Muda of waiting. Second, the can and the aluminum going into it are picked up and put down 30 times. From the customer's standpoint, none of this adds any value. The Muda of transport. Similarly, the aluminum and cans are moved through 14 storage locations and warehouses, many of them vast, and the cans are palletized and unpalletized 4 times, the Muda of inventories and of excess processing. Finally, fully 24% of the energy-intensive, expensive aluminum coming out of the smelter never makes it to the customer, the Muda of defects causing scrap. The simplest way to think about this situation is that a can of cola is very small, and cola is consumed by the individual customer in small amounts. Yet all of the apparatus used to make cola and to get it to the customer is very large, very hard to change over, and designed to operate efficiently at very high speeds. The boats, warehouses, and processing machines we have been describing are truly massive, and we can see that the primary objective of the technologist in the beverage industry has been to scale up and speed up this equipment while removing direct labor, in a classic application of the ideas of mass production. However, what appears to be efficient to individual companies along the stream, for example, the purchase of the world's fastest canning machines, operating at 1,500 cans per minute to yield the world's lowest fill cost per can, may be far from efficient when indirect labor for technical support, upstream and downstream inventories, handling charges, and storage costs are included. Indeed, this machine may be much more expensive than a smaller, simpler, slower one able to make just what the next firm down the stream needs, Tesco in this case, and to produce it immediately upon receipt of the order rather than shipping from a large inventory. For the moment, let's just re-emphasize the critical leap in embracing value stream thinking. Stop looking at aggregated activities and isolated machines, the smelter, the rolling mill, the warehouse, and the can filling machine. Start looking at all the specific actions required to produce specific products to see how they interact with each other. Then start to challenge those actions which singly and in combination don't actually create or optimize value for the customer. Ordering cola. If it takes 319 days to bring a cola from bauxite to Tesco, and a similar amount of time to make most of the other items along Tesco's aisles, there's a clear problem in ordering. Either orders must be completely uniform over time so the producers all along the stream can operate stable schedules with little inventory, or the upstream producers must maintain large inventories at every stage to deal with shifts in demand, or Tesco's customers must learn to live with shortages. None of these is desirable because all create muda. In fact, we encountered Tesco because this firm has made remarkable progress in recent years in streamlining its ordering system to avoid these choices. It has dramatically reduced stockouts, a situation of not having a product the customer wants, while also slashing its own in-store and warehouse inventories by more than half. Because Tesco was already one of the most efficient grocers in the world when it started this process, it appears that its current inventories are only half the United Kingdom average, a quarter the European average, and an eighth the North American average. However, Tesco has recently realized that to move even further in reducing inventories, stockouts, and cost on a total system basis, where more than 85% of the cost of a typical product like cola are outside Tesco's corporate control, it will need to improve responsiveness and ordering accuracy all the way up its value stream, running across 7 firms in this particular case. To understand why Tesco reached this conclusion, let's look at their current order-taking system, which is probably the most advanced in the world. Tesco installed a point-of-sale barcode scanning system in the checkout lanes of all its stores in the mid-1980s. This permitted each store to maintain a perpetual inventory of exactly how much of every item it had on hand and to make more accurate orders to suppliers. This was possible because every time a customer in the aisle took a carton of cola past the checkout, the system noted this fact along with the recent rate of sales and the number of cartons remaining. Replenishment orders could be automatically generated. A few years later, Tesco transferred decision-making on what each store would purchase and when from the store manager, who had been ordering directly from each supplier, to a centralized system where Tesco placed orders combined from all its stores to suppliers. At the same time, it opened a dozen regional distribution centers, RDCs, in England, so that suppliers for more than 95% of all sales volume, the exceptions being milk, sugar, and bread, would ship to the RDC rather than the store. Instead of sending a small truck partially loaded to each store, each supplier could send a large truck to each RDC, and Tesco could send another large truck to the retail store each night. In 1989, Tesco took a revolutionary step for the grocery industry by moving toward daily orders, rather than weekly or even monthly orders, for all fresh products and for many long shelf-life items. When each store takes inventory at the end of each day, the Tesco ordering system calculates the quantity needed to restore normal stocks, plus any special demand likely to be caused by the day of the week, the time of year, the weather, or a sales promotion. After a quick review by the store manager to check for glitches in the assumptions, this information is dispatched to Tesco's central computer. There, the requirements from all stores in each region are accumulated and orders are dispatched electronically to each supplier during the night. The suppliers are given a precise time, within 15 minutes, on a precise day, to have the precise amount of goods delivered to a specific receiving dock in each RDC. When the goods arrive at the RDC, they are taken to an area on the floor assigned to each store and consolidated as a load to be taken that night from the RDC to the store, arriving early in the morning. Thus, orders made by each Tesco store on Monday night result in replenishment goods from suppliers reaching each store before it opens on Wednesday morning, effectively creating a 24-hour continuous replenishment system. As a result of this system of daily replenishment, Tesco has increased the service level to its retail stores, the percentage of supplier shipments which arrive exactly on time in good condition and exactly the right amount, from 92 to 98.5%. At the same time, the stocks on hand of the average good in retail stores plus the RDCs fell from 21 to 12.8 days. For fast movers like cola, accounting for more than half of Tesco's total sales, inventories at the RDC and the retail store combined are now only 3 to 5 days. However, as Tesco did this, they learned the limits of what can be accomplished by one firm alone. Specifically, first-tier suppliers like its bottler have been fulfilling Tesco orders nightly just in time, but from massive finished goods inventories. Their production methods, with high-speed machines, long changeover times, and large batches, have given them no real choice. Meanwhile, the firms further up the value stream from the bottler, also using massive high-speed machines with long changeovers to produce large batches, have not yet even taken the step of delivering just-in-time from finished goods inventories. Because the bottler cannot get rapid response from its upstream suppliers to changing levels of demand, it continues to order batches of goods at weekly, monthly, or even quarterly intervals in the case of some raw materials. If Tesco wants to shrink cost and improve the reliability of the 85% of the value stream it does not directly control, it's obvious that the upstream firms must collectively rethink their operating methods, and this is how Tesco and the Lead Enterprise Research Center join forces. While it is still in the early stages, the process of jointly conducting the analysis just described should gradually change Tesco, the bottler, the can maker, the cold roller, the hot roller, the smelter, and the bauxite miner from 7 isolated adversaries into a team of collaborators, indeed, into a lean enterprise. Creating cola. The final element in the cola story is the value stream for product development. Historically, in the grocery business, first-tier suppliers like the bottler or the branded purveyor of goods have been responsible for the great bulk of product innovations and introductions. Yet only a brief effort to list the activities in the value stream culminating in the launch of a new product raises many questions. Typically, a firm like the bottler is continually looking for new products to defend its current market share, to expand its scope of offerings, or justify more shelf space at Tesco, and to substitute products with higher margins for old standbys like cola. In the industry, the typical product development cycle is about 1 year and consists of a number of product clinics followed by larger product trials, culminating in the decision for a full-scale launch. Although the actual steps involved are very simple and typically involve very little true research and development, they are conducted sequentially so that if one looks down on a product concept from a bird's eye view, it is quickly apparent that during most of the development period, the concept is sitting still, awaiting feedback from the group which conducts the clinics on all of the firm's products, or awaiting its place on the schedule of the department which conducts small-scale market trials for all products. Then, when the decision to launch is made, there's more waiting while the production system is adapted to accept the new product, new packaging materials are developed, and the marketing campaign is planned. The end result of this system is that new products, which are often new only in the sense of having reformulated ingredients, for example, caffeine-free and cherry cola, cost an average of $15 million to launch, half of this going to advertising, and they usually fail in the marketplace. The result for Tesco is large amounts of shelf space tied up with new products that don't sell and are launched at the same time in the stores of its direct competitors. The obvious question is, how can it take a year's development time and $15 million in expenditure to introduce a new product which isn't new and which no one wants? Simply reducing development time and expense, while highly desirable, will not be enough to have much effect on this value stream, So Tesco has started to rethink the product development process on a more fundamental level in terms of value. Perhaps, just as the individual steps in the value stream are incomprehensible in isolation, customers do not really want to shop for isolated items. Would it perhaps be better for Tesco and its bottler to jointly undertake the development of the full complement of beverages necessary to keep Tesco customers happy, and for Tesco to develop longer-term relations with its customers so they would not be strangers? Toward this end, Tesco has just launched a frequent shopper program that will gather purchase pattern data on every regular customer and should permit a more coherent value stream in product development. Putting value stream analysis to work. Having looked at the specific steps involved in the value stream for one specific product, we are ready to put our findings to work more broadly. In the cola case, we do not see any steps in the third category, which can be immediately eliminated because they are simply redundant. Instead, we see a large number of steps in the second category. They clearly add no value, they're muda, and therefore they become targets for elimination by application of lean techniques. Note that in performing this analysis, we are not benchmarking by comparing Tesco's value stream with those of its competitors. Lean benchmarkers who discover their performance is superior to their competitors have a natural tendency to relax, the risk Tesco would run today in benchmarking its internal operations, while mass producers discovering that their performance is inferior often have a hard time understanding exactly why. For example, General Motors and Volkswagen in the 1980s. They tend to get distracted by easy-to-measure or impossible-to-emulate differences in factor cost, scale, or culture when the really important differences lie in the harder-to-see ways value-creating activities are organized. Our earnest advice to lean firms today is simple. To hell with your competitors. Compete against perfection by identifying all activities that are muda and eliminating them. This is an absolute rather than a relative standard, which can provide the essential North Star for any organization. In its most spectacular application, it has kept the Toyota organization in the lead for 40 years. However, to put this admonition to work, you must master the key techniques for eliminating muda. It all begins with flow. Flow. The world of batch and queue. What happens when you go to your doctor? Usually you make an appointment some days ahead, then arrive at the appointed time and sit in the waiting room. When the doctor sees you, usually behind schedule, she or he makes a judgment about what your problem is likely to be. You are then routed to the appropriate specialist, quite possibly on another day, certainly after sitting in another waiting room. Your specialist will need to order tests using large, dedicated laboratory equipment, requiring another wait, and then another visit to review the results. Then, if the nature of the problem is clear, it's time for the appropriate treatment, perhaps involving a trip to the pharmacy and another line, perhaps a trip back to the specialist for a complex procedure, complete with wait. If you are unlucky and require hospital treatment, you enter a whole new world of specialized functions, disconnected processes, and waiting. If you take a moment to reflect on your experience, you discover that the amount of time actually spent on your treatment was a tiny fraction of the time you spent going through the process. Mostly you were sitting and waiting. Patient is clearly the right word. Or moving about to the next step in the diagnosis and treatment. You put up with this because you've been told that all this stopping and starting and being handed off to strangers is the price of efficiency in receiving the highest quality care. We've already looked briefly at another service, a trip involving an airline. Healthcare and travel are usually called personal services, in contrast with products like VCRs, washing machines, wire molds, wire guides, Tesco's beverages. Actually, the major difference is that in the case of healthcare and travel, you, the customer, are being acted upon. You are necessarily part of the production process. With goods, by contrast, you wait at the end of the process, seemingly beyond harm's reach, However, there's no escaping the consequences of the way the job gets done, even if you're not directly involved. Let's take just one example of a common good, the single-family home. Henry Ford dreamed about mass-producing homes using standard but modularized designs, with the modules built in factories to slash design and production cost while still providing variety. A number of entrepreneurs actually created modular designs and briefly set up production lines in the United States to make the modules for prefabricated homes immediately after World War II. And Toyota has had modest success in Japan since the 1960s in offering a wide range of floor plans and exterior appearances using a few basic modules fabricated on a production line and assembled almost instantly at the construction site. Yet, almost all of the world's new single-family homes are still built largely at the construction site by cutting and fastening a welter of materials to create the basic structure and then installing thousands of individual components from plumbing fixtures to kitchen appliances to wall sockets. If you go to your home builder and then to the construction site and take a seat to watch the action, you'll mostly note inaction. For example, when Doyle Wilson started to measure what occurred in his office and at the work site as part of his TQM effort, he discovered that 5/6 of the typical construction schedule for a custom-built home was occupied with two activities. One was the activity of waiting for the next set of specialists, architects, cost estimators, bill of material drafters, landscape architects, roofers, sheetrockers, plumbers, electricians, landscapers, to work a particular job into their complex schedules. The second activity was rework, to rip out and correct the work just done that was either incorrect from a technical standpoint or failed to meet the needs and expectations of the home buyer. As the buyer at the end of the process, you pay for all the waiting and rework, grumbling, of course, but it is a custom product after all, and you've heard many stories from your friends about an even worse problem with their homes, so you tend to accept the predominant system and its problems as unavoidable and inherent in the nature of the activity. In fact, all of these activities, the creation, ordering, and provision of any good or service, can be made to flow. And when we start thinking about ways to line up all the essential steps needed to get a job done into a steady, continuous flow with no wasted motion, no interruptions, no batches, and no queues, it changes everything. How we work together, the kinds of tools we devise to help with our work, the organizations we create to facilitate the flow, the kinds of careers we pursue, the nature of business firms, including nonprofit service providers, and their linkages to each other and society. Applying flow to the full range of human activities will not be easy or automatic. For starters, it's hard for most managers to even see the flow of value and therefore to grasp the value of flow. Then, once managers begin to see, many practical problems must be overcome to fully introduce and sustain flow. However, we do insist that flow principles can be applied to any activity and that the consequences are always dramatic. Indeed, the amount of human effort, time, space, tools, and inventories needed to design and provide a given service or good can typically be cut in half very quickly, and steady progress can be maintained from this point onward to cut inputs in half again within a few years. The techniques of flow. So, how do you make value flow? The first step, once value is defined and the entire value stream is identified, is to focus on the actual object, the specific design, the specific order, and the product itself, a trip, a house, a bicycle, and never let it out of sight from beginning to completion. The second step, which makes the first step possible, is to ignore the traditional boundaries of jobs, careers, functions, often organized into departments, and firms, to form a lean enterprise removing all impediments to the continuous flow of the specific product or product family. The third step is to rethink specific work practices and tools to eliminate backflows, scrap, and stoppages of all sorts so that the design, order, and production of the specific product can proceed continuously. In fact, these three steps must be taken together. Most managers imagine that the requirements of efficiency dictate that designs, orders, and products go through the system, and that good management consists of avoiding variances in the performance of the complex system handling a wide variety of products. The real need is to get rid of the system and start over on a new basis. To make this approach clear and specific, let's take a concrete example, the design, ordering, and production of a bicycle. From batch to flow in bicycles. We've chosen this example partly because the bicycle itself is simple and lacks glamour. You will not be distracted by novel product designs or exotic technologies. We've also chosen it because we happen to know something about the bicycle industry, one of us having resolved to test the methods we describe in this book by taking an ownership position in a real bicycle company. Finally, we have chosen bicycle manufacturer because it is a deeply disintegrated industry, with most final assembler firms making only the frame while buying the components, wheels, brakes, gears, seats, handlebars, plus raw materials in the form of frame tubing, from a long list of supplier companies, many larger than the final assemblers themselves. The problems of value stream integration are present in abundance. Design. Product design in the bicycle industry was historically a classic batch and queue affair in which the marketing department determined a need, the product engineers then designed a product to serve the need, the prototype department built a prototype to test the design, the tooling department designed tools to make a high-volume version of the approved prototype, and the production engineering group in the manufacturing department figured out how to use the tools to fabricate the frame and then assemble the component parts into a completed bike. Once the design was finalized, the purchasing department arranged to buy the necessary component parts for delivery to the assembly hall. A design for a new product, usually only one of many under development at a given time, moved from department to department, waiting in the queue in each department. Frequently, it went back for rework to a previous department or was secretly re-engineered at a point downstream to deal with incompatibilities between the perspectives of, say, the tool designers and the product designers who handled the design in the previous step. There was no flow. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, most firms switched to a heavyweight program management with a strong team leader and a few dedicated team members, but without changing the rest of the system. The product team was really just a committee with a staff that sent the great bulk of the actual development work back to the departments, where it still waited in queues. What's more, there was no effective methodology for carrying designs through the system without lots of rework and backflows. Even worse, no one was really responsible for the final results of development efforts because the accounting and reward systems never linked the success of a product through its production life with the original efforts of the design team. There was, therefore, a bias toward ingenious designs with admirable technical features, which customers liked, but which failed to return a profit due to excess costs and launch delays. The lean approach is to create truly dedicated product teams with all the skills needed to conduct value specification, general design, detailed engineering, purchasing, tooling, and production planning in one room in a short period of time using a proved team decision-making methodology, commonly called quality function deployment. This method permits development teams to standardize work so that a team follows the same approach every time. Because every team in a firm also follows this approach, it's possible to accurately measure throughput times and to continually improve the design methodology itself. With a truly dedicated team in place, rigorously using QFD to correctly specify value and then eliminate rework and backflows, the design never stops moving forward until it's fully in production. The result is to reduce development time by more than half in the amount of effort needed by more than half while getting a much higher hit rate of products which actually speak to the needs of customers. In our experience, dedicated product teams do not need to be nearly as large as traditional managers would predict, and the smaller they can be kept, the better all around. A host of narrowly skilled specialists are not needed because most marketing, engineering, purchasing, and production professionals actually have much broader skills than they have ever realized, ever admitted, or ever been allowed to use. When a small team is given the mandate to just do it, we always find that the professionals suddenly discover that each can successfully cover a much broader scope of task than they have ever been allowed to previously. They do the job well, and they enjoy it. Order taking. The historic practice in the bicycle industry has been to task the sales department with obtaining orders from retailers. In the United States, these range from the giant mass marketers like Walmart at one extreme to thousands of tiny independent bicycle shops at the other. When the orders are fully processed to make sure that they are internally consistent and that the buyer is creditworthy, they are sent to the scheduling department in operations or manufacturing to work into the complex production algorithm for a firm's many products. The shipment date is then set for communication back to sales and on to the customer. To check on the progress of orders, particularly in the event of late delivery, the customer calls sales, which then calls scheduling. When orders are really late and important customers threaten to cancel, sales and scheduling undertake some form of expediting by going directly into the physical production system in both the assembler firm and the supply base to move laggard orders forward. This is done by jumping them to the head of each queue in physical production. In the lean enterprise, sales and production scheduling are core members of the product team in a position to plan the sales campaign as the product design is being developed and to sell with a clear eye to the capabilities of the production system so that both orders and the product can flow smoothly from sale to delivery. And because there are no stoppages in the production system and products are built to order, with only a few hours elapsed between the first operation on raw materials and shipment of the finished item, orders can be sought and accepted with a clear and precise knowledge of the system's capabilities. There is no expediting. A key technique in implementing this approach is the concept of tack time, that's T-A-K-T, which precisely synchronizes the rate of production to the rate of sales to customers. For example, for a bicycle firm's high-end titanium frame bike, let's assume that customers are placing orders at the rate of 48 per day. Let's also assume that the bike factory works a single 8-hour shift. Dividing the number of bikes by the available hours of production tells the production time per bicycle, the tack time, which is 10 minutes. 60 minutes in an hour divided by demand of 6 bikes per hour. Obviously, the aggregate volume of orders may increase or decrease over time, and tack time will need to be adjusted so that production is always precisely synchronized with demand. The point is always to define tack time precisely at a given time in relation to demand and to run the whole production sequence precisely to tack time. In the lean enterprise, the production slots created by the tack time calculation, perhaps 10 per hour for high-end bicycles for a tack time of 6 minutes, and 1 per minute for low-end models for a tack time of 60 seconds, are clearly posted. This can be done with a simple whiteboard in the product team area at the final assembler, but will probably also involve electronic displays, often called Andon boards, in the assembler firm, and electronic transmission for display in supplier and customer facilities as well. Complete display, so everyone can see where production stands at every moment, is an excellent example of another critical lean technique, transparency, or visual control. Transparency facilitates consistently producing to tack time and alerts the whole team immediately to the need either for additional orders or to think of ways to remove waste if tack time needs to be reduced to accommodate an increase in orders. Raising awareness of the tight connection between sales and production also helps guard against one of the great evils of traditional selling and order-taking systems, namely the resort to bonus systems to motivate a sales force working with no real knowledge of or concern about the capabilities of the production system. These methods produce periodic surges in orders at the end of each bonus period, even though underlying demand hasn't changed, and an occasional order of the century drummed up by a bonus-hungry sales staff, which the production system can't possibly accommodate. Both lead to late deliveries and bad will from the customer. In other words, they magically generate muda. Production. The historic practice in the bicycle industry was to differentiate production activities by type and to create departments for each type of activity. Tube cutting, tube bending, mitering, welding, washing, and painting for the frame and handlebars, and final assembly of the complete bike. Over time, higher speed machines with higher levels of automation were developed for tasks ranging from cutting and bending to welding and painting. Assembly lines were also installed to assemble a mix of high volume models in dedicated assembly halls. All bike makers produced a wide range of models using the same production equipment, and part fabrication tools typically ran at much higher speeds, expressed as pieces per minute, than the final assembly line. Because changing over part fabrication tools to make a different part was typically quite time-consuming, it made sense to make large batches of each part before changing over to run the next part. As batches of parts were created, an obvious problem arose: how to keep track of the inventory and make sure that the right parts were sent to the right operation at the right time. In the early days of the bicycle industry, an activity dating back to the 1880s and a key precursor to the auto industry, scheduling was handled by means of a master schedule and daily handwritten orders to each department to make the parts final assembly would need. After nearly 100 years, these manual scheduling methods were replaced in the 1970s by computerized material requirements planning systems, or MRPs. A good MRP system was at least 99% accurate in keeping track of inventory, ordering materials, and sending instructions to each department on what to make next. As a group, these systems were a clear improvement on older manual systems for controlling batch and queue operations, and became progressively more complex over time. Eventually, capacity planning tools were added to evaluate the capacity of machines at every step in the production process and to guard against the emergence of bottlenecks and capacity constraints. MRP, however, had a number of problems. If even one part was not properly logged into the system as it proceeded from one production stage to the next, errors began to accumulate that played havoc with the reorder triggers telling a department when to switch over to the next type of part. As a result, downstream manufacturing operations often had too many parts, the muda of overproduction, or too few parts to meet the production schedule, producing the muda of waiting. A worse problem was that total lead times in batch and queue systems were usually quite lengthy, typically a few weeks to a few months between the point in time when the earliest upstream part was produced and the moment when a bike containing that part was shipped to the retailer. This would have been fine if orders had been perfectly smooth. But in fact, orders received by the bike manufacturer changed all the time, partly due to the bonus-driven selling system, partly due to the substantial inventories in the retail channel, and partly due to seasonal demand patterns, particularly for low-end bikes. What's more, there were often engineering changes in bicycle designs, even for mature products, meaning that a considerable fraction of the parts piled up alongside the value stream were suddenly either completely obsolete or in need of rework. MRP systems, which were very simple in concept, therefore became exceedingly complex in practice. Just in time, an innovation pioneered at Toyota in the 1950s and first embraced by Western firms in the early 1980s was designed to deal with many of these problems. This technique was envisioned by Taichi Ono as a method for facilitating smooth flow. But JIT can only work effectively if machine changeovers are dramatically slashed, so that upstream manufacturing operations produce tiny amounts of each part and then produce another tiny amount as soon as the amount already produced is summoned by the next process downstream. JIT is also helpless unless downstream production steps practice level scheduling, hey Junka in Toyota speak, to smooth out the perturbations in day-to-day order flow unrelated to actual customer demand. Otherwise, bottlenecks will quickly emerge upstream and buffers, safety stocks, will be introduced everywhere to prevent them. To get manufactured goods to flow, the Lean Enterprise takes the critical concepts of JIT and level scheduling and carries them all the way to their logical conclusion by putting products into continuous flow wherever possible. For example, in the case of the bicycle plant, flow thinking calls for the creation of production areas by product family, which includes every fabrication and assembly step. Product families can be defined in various ways, but in this industry they would logically be defined by the base material used for the frame, specifically titanium, aluminum, steel, or carbon fiber. This classification makes sense because the fabrication steps and processing techniques are quite different in each case. Better yet, if noise problems can be managed, the Lean Enterprise groups the product manager, the parts buyer, the manufacturing engineer, and the production scheduler in the team area immediately next to the actual production equipment and in close contact with the product and tool engineers in the nearby design area dedicated to that product family. The old-fashioned and destructive distinction between the office, where people work with their minds, and the plant, where people work with their hands, is eliminated. In the continuous flow layout, the production steps are arranged in a sequence, usually within a cell, and the product moves from one step to the next, one bike at a time, with no buffer of work in process in between, using a range of techniques generically labeled single-piece flow. To achieve single-piece flow, in the normal situation when each product family includes many product variants, in this case, touring and mountain bike designs in a wide range of sizes, it is essential that each machine can be converted almost instantly from one product specification to the next. It's also essential that many traditionally massive machines, paint systems being the most critical in the bike case, be right-sized to fit directly into the production process. This, in turn, often means using machines which are simpler, less automated, and slower, but perhaps even more accurate and repeatable than traditional designs. This approach seems completely backward to traditional managers who have been told all their lives that competitive advantage in manufacture is obtained from automating, linking, and speeding up massive machinery to increase throughput and remove direct labor. It also seems like common sense that good production management involves keeping every employee busy and every machine fully utilized to justify the capital invested in the expensive machines. What traditional managers fail to grasp is the cost of maintaining and coordinating a complicated network of high-speed machines making batches. This is the muda of complexity. Because conventional standard cost accounting systems make machine utilization and employee utilization their key performance measures, while treating in-process inventories as an asset, even if no one will ever want them, it's not surprising that managers also fail to grasp that machines rapidly making unwanted parts during 100% of their available hours and employees earnestly performing unneeded tasks during every available minute, are only producing muda. To get continuous flow systems to flow for more than a minute or two at a time, every machine and every worker must be completely capable. That is, they must always be in proper condition to run precisely when needed and every part made must be exactly right. By design, flow systems have an everything works or nothing works quality, which must be respected and anticipated. This means that the production team must be cross-skilled in every task, in case someone is absent or needed for another task, and that the machinery must be made 100% available and accurate through a series of techniques called Total Productive Maintenance, TPM. It also means that work must be rigorously standardized by the work team, not by some remote industrial engineering group, and that employees and machines must be taught to monitor their own work through a series of techniques commonly called poka-yoke, or mistake-proofing, which make it impossible for even one defective part to be sent ahead to the next step. A simple example of a poka-yoke is installing photocells across the opening of each parts bin at a workstation. When a product of a given description enters the area, the worker must reach into the boxes to get parts, breaking the light beam from the photocell on each box. If the worker attempts to move the product on to the next station without obtaining the right parts, a light flashes to indicate that a part has been left out. These techniques need to be coupled with visual controls, including status indicators, often in the form of Andon boards, clearly posted up-to-date standard work charts, and displays of key measurables and financial information on the cost of the process. The precise techniques will vary with the application, but the key principle does not. Everyone involved must be able to see and understand every aspect of the operation and its status at all times. Once the commitment is made to convert to a flow system, striking progress can be made very quickly in the initial kaikaku exercise. However, some tools, for example, massive paint booths with elaborate emission control equipment, will be unsuited for continuous flow production and won't be easy to modify quickly. It will be necessary to operate them for an extended period in a batch mode with intermediate buffers of parts between the previous and the next production step. The key technique here is to think through tool changes to reduce changeover times and batch sizes to the absolute minimum that existing machinery will permit. This typically can be done very quickly and almost never requires major capital investments. Indeed, if you think you need to spend large sums to convert equipment from large batches to small batches or single pieces, you don't yet understand lean thinking. The original small lot quick change techniques pioneered at Toyota in the 1960s are a striking achievement, but we caution readers not to take quick change machines still producing batches, however small, as an end in themselves. Any changeover requiring any loss in production time in any machine which must run at a rate far out of step with the rest of the production sequence can still create muda. The end objective of flow thinking is to totally eliminate all stoppages in an entire production process and not to rest in the area of tool design until this has been achieved. Let's tie all of these techniques together by showing what a lean bicycle production process looks like. First, although the same number of bikes are being produced, only half the space is needed, in large part because all of the in-process storage areas have disappeared. The human effort needed to produce a bicycle has been cut in half as well, and time through the system has been reduced from 4 weeks to 4 hours. Single large machines have been broken down into multiple small machines, in particular the washing systems and paint booths, so that bikes can proceed continuously one at a time from tube cutting to mitering to bending to welding to washing to painting to final assembly without ever stopping. In this arrangement, the inventory between workstations can be zero, and the size of the work team can be geared to the production volume of the cell, with high-volume cells having more workers than low-volume cells. Finally, track assembly operations have been eliminated. When production is broken into product families, it is often the case that no family accounts for the kind of volume needed for track assembly. Remarkably, manual advancing of the product through assembly is often cheaper. Because the workflow has been so drastically simplified, the MRP system and the accompanying expediters are no longer needed to get parts from step to step. MRP is still used for long-term capacity planning for the assembler firm and its suppliers. When the sequence is initiated at the end of final assembly, work progresses from each station to the next in accordance with tack time and at the same rate as final assembly. The entire product team, including the team leader, the production engineer, the planner buyer, the TPM maintenance expert, and the operators, collectively the heart of the lean enterprise, can be located immediately adjacent to the machinery for each product cell. Because the process machinery currently available for these operations in the bicycle industry either makes very little noise inherently, for example, paint, or can be shielded so that very little noise escapes into the team area, the mitering step, it's possible to lay out activities so everyone can see the whole operation and its status at a quick glance. A final point about the cells is that the work in each step has been very carefully balanced with the work in every other step so that everyone is working to a cycle time equal to tack time. When it's necessary to speed up or slow down production, the size of the team may be increased or shrunk, contracting or expanding job scope, but the actual pace of physical effort is never changed. When the specification of the product changes, the right size machines can be added or subtracted and adjusted or rearranged so that continuous flow is always maintained. Right location. Only one more flow technique needs mentioning, which is to locate both design and physical production in the appropriate place to serve the customer. Just as many manufacturers have concentrated on installing larger and faster machines to eliminate direct labor, they've also gone toward massive centralized facilities for product families, sometimes called focus factories, while outsourcing more and more of the actual component part making to other centralized facilities serving many final assemblers. To make matters worse, these are often located on the wrong side of the world from both their engineering operations and their customers, Taiwan in the bicycle case, to reduce the cost per hour of labor. The production process in these remotely located high-scale facilities may even be in some form of flow, but launching products and improving the process machinery is much harder, because the core of engineering skills are on the other side of the world, and the flow of products stops at the end of the plant. In the case of bikes, it's a matter of letting the finished product sit while a whole sea container for a given final assembler's warehouse in North America is filled, then sending the filled containers to the port, where they sit some more, waiting for a giant container ship. After a few weeks on the ocean, the containers go by truck to one of the bike firm's regional warehouses, where the bikes wait until a specific customer order needs filling, often followed by shipment to the customer's warehouse for more waiting. In other words, there's no flow.